So, welcome, welcome. Yeah. We are already recording. So, I'm just going to go ahead and say, like, hi, everyone. Welcome to the Resource Cast.
No,
I'm here with
no,
Lucas Sanfiran.
Lucas is here. No,
Lucas is here.
No,
hey, Lucas.
No.
How are you doing?
No. Don't do it like that. You act like a professional.
Let me restart everything. Act like a professional. Forget to introduce Lucas and carry on. Okay.
Does Lucas start one interview and then you go, or is it always you first?
It's usually this interruption game that we play.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure everyone loves it.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like, can I? No, you. Oh, okay, cool. And then we do that for like 45 minutes and then we end the interview. That's it. That's
amazing.
So we haven't got a synopsis written out for this. We don't have a whole big, massive plan because I think we more or less know what we want to talk about, which is basically get your perspective on what's been going on in film production land during lockdown and slow release of lockdown and now fucking lockdown 2.0 and all that kind of thing. So we'll start there. And so now I'm going to do the professional introduction. Lucas, can I go ahead?
Yeah, you can. You may. I will allow it.
Will you? Okay, awesome. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Resource Cast episode. I don't know what anymore. Lockdown continues, and we are getting together after a little bit of a hiatus. My wife had a baby, and I'm not getting much sleep, and things have been quite busy. So we are taking a quick break from regularly scheduled pooing and screaming to have a chat with Porteous Zandau, who is, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Hi, Porteous.
Hi. I'm also here.
And Lucas is here. I said that in the previous introduction, but, you know. Hey, I'm introducing our guest. You can wait. Yeah, so Lucas is here.
He's made it thus far.
Yeah, exactly. He's still with us, even after the break.
Every time.
Yeah. So Porteous is a director. He's worked with a few production companies. And who is your – you're starting up your own vibe right now, right?
Something like that.
But what is that? NDA.
I'm not starting up my own thing completely. I mean, I'm represented by Carbon Films here in South Africa. But the thing that we're starting up is a side project. So can't talk about that just yet.
Okay. Cool. So yeah.
If that's okay, if we can talk about it offline. Yeah.
No. We can catch up on super secret side projects later. Mm. But yeah, you're working with Carbon right now, and yeah, basically we wanted to chat to you as someone who's in the world of production, and there are quite a few professionals on the Resource who are in the production world. But production also has its own Facebook groups. It's got its own ecosystem. It's a family. It's a whole big community, right? But we wanted to catch up with your side of the world and see, you know, what's been going on for the crews, for the directors, for the companies. Like, has it been pure hell, or is it recovering? Let's start with the beginning of lockdown level 5. What happened?
I can obviously only really speak from, because we are kind of... we are broken up, unfortunately. It's not like we're this like really big, happy family of people that work in the film industry and everyone's connected. Unfortunately, just it's not, you know, even though you sort of know people, you don't necessarily obviously talk the whole time. But from my perspective, I mean, obviously lockdown started. We were just about to head into production, start filming, and then obviously everything came crashing down. At least for myself, two jobs got cancelled essentially, especially because, how can I make this as simple as possible? Basically, what I used to rely on quite a lot was international clients coming to South Africa. So it's not like I've, was that heavily dependent on South African productions. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, obviously, since then, the travel ban, of course, things just kind of went to shit, and so barren completely.
Wasteland.
From a local perspective, I mean, I was pitching on some, and it's kind of been quite nice. The last couple, I'd say the last 2 years or so have been quite nice, where you know, picking up momentum, slowly but surely, locally got signed with Carbon. They've been lovely. And then obviously that also came to a grinding halt. So again, that's just from, I mean, I can again only really speak from my experience is that some people have had it really great where there seems to have been a few jobs that have sort of come through the cracks and they've managed to actually make it work. You know, some people have been shooting remotely, which has been really nice. But I would say probably about, I'd say at least from my connections and the people that I speak to, a good 80% have just gone to shit and kind of haven't really been able to do much, because obviously it's not like we can't shoot, we can shoot, but majority of the clients have just put a halt to spend, you know, their advertising spend.
Yeah.
And so everything's on hold from that point of view.
Sure. Right.
So yeah.
Hectic. Okay. And now that, you know, with the recent kind of reducing of lockdown levels and all that, are you seeing and crews being allowed to shoot? And I mean, speaking as a copywriter, I've worked on now two projects where I was writing copy to explain two remote working solutions, essentially for production. And so I'm definitely obviously seeing that side of it in the same way that events is going very digital. But then also the real side of it is slowly climbing back up the precipice. And is it normalizing or is it still very much in a bad place?
I think it's, I mean, from, again, from the amounts of briefs that are actually floating around, people that are actually pitching on stuff, as far as I understand, even though, like I said, you know, there seems to be some murmurs of more things happening, it's still pretty damn quiet. But from a working point of view, I have heard some pretty great stories of local, usually more service-based. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with
production services.
What that? Yeah, just obviously people servicing foreigners. They've been having quite a nice uptake, especially with working remotely. In fact, I'm shooting something in September, more or less, where I was supposed to travel to Europe to go and shoot this commercial, and now obviously I can't travel. So at least the clients as well have been quite cool with being open to this whole new concept. I mean, if you think about it, it's actually kind of crazy to think that the director won't be on set, which I think is sort of suicide in many ways, but we're kind of navigating it and just taking it as it comes. I haven't done it before, so I can't really say how it's gonna happen, but that's just how we're rolling with it, and it's so far so good. But I can kind of give you feedback in a few months down the line to see if it actually if it was a success or not,
right?
But I guess the long and short is it's not really ideal, even with the and not that it's necessarily that important, but I mean, even with the I think it was level 4 when level 4 got on, you know, was introduced, where we allowed to start shooting again. It was all, you know, with the curfew, it still kind of broke up your day where you couldn't shoot in the best light of the day, which right. Again, yeah. You're limited to basically shooting studio. Or inside someone's house, of course, but I mean, you kind of want to have, you know, the best time of the day, which is again another story in itself.
Sure.
If I can ask you, has there I can imagine if the briefs are coming through and it is Golden Sunset opening and then the rest of the script plays out, that there's had to be adaptations to the scripts. And I'm not saying that you would know this, but I'm just kind of spitballing here, because I can imagine a lot of rewrites on things to help to accommodate the production process. Example, if it was going to be exterior, now it's an interior shot. So there are creative ways, I'm assuming, to work around, I suppose, these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it makes 100% sense. And I think if you have people that are what's the right word? They flexible enough to be cool for the stories to be changed, then of course, then that would be the case. But I mean, if you're shooting Sunrise Chickens, you know, where you kind of want the sunrise, it's sort of, yeah. You know, you require it, but
I've got a feeling that a lot of libraries are going to be used in this time as well, stock footage and stuff like that. But it's when you were talking about shooting remotely, this kind of excites from, like, look, I think we would sit on opposite sides of the production process, not opposites, but like agency versus production. And I see a lot of the shit. If you watch Instagram and you look at other art directors and their feeds are coming in, they're going, they're shooting remotely. They're doing it from their house. The director and the DOP are on set. They're the ones risking getting sick, while the agency and the client are comfy in their living rooms on their phones going, I don't know, maybe they can do it again. So yeah,
it's a bit grainy.
There is a certain amount of uncharted territory which I always think, again, I'm probably going to be accused of being toxically optimistic on this stuff, but this idea of finding better ways to work. So from a budget point of view, you look at production process, you go, okay, cool, I need the agency there, I need the copywriters, the clients, and then I have to feed them, transport them, all this stuff. So now there's the opportunity to kind of make that work better. Like opportunity in this chaos.
Yeah, I mean, in the last couple of years, you know, unfortunately, with WhatsApp already, I think, you know, you would be standing on sets, and then suddenly, there'd be this, someone would just say, okay, whoa, stop from clients. You know, this is the client now. You know, we never got the approval on the whatever the key prop is, the mug. Is the yellow of the mug the right color? And then suddenly someone takes some pictures, sends it off WhatsApp to wherever the client might be. And suddenly you're sitting and waiting for those approvals, which isn't ideal, but then that would usually be no one sitting and waiting. Whereas if you have, if we're now geared towards where clients are actually sitting and participating in the shoot, and I've had one shoot early in the year where the client was actually, well, not the client, but the agency producer was sitting, not in the country, and live, you know, essentially live, voyeuristically, just checking if everyone was doing what they're supposed to be doing. But I think it is great, especially I think for South Africans, the fact that South Africa has, you know, it used to be really, really cheap. It's not that cheap anymore to come and shoot here. So if you don't necessarily need to fly everyone over to come to South Africa, then we potentially could start being competitive again. But what stops, you know, Europeans from just doing the same thing with Eastern Europe? If they want to send a director and a cinematographer over to Slovenia, where the case may be, it makes sense potentially for them to, again, just shoot remotely, but just send them like two countries away instead of all the way down to South Africa. Not that I'm trying to punt Eastern Europe, but that's just
the landscapes that we have here. The landscapes we have here again will be such a differentiator for especially international stuff. You know, you can't beat Chapman's Peak driving shots and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I suppose also now it's the difference. So when travel doesn't become an option, now it's just vision and treatment. So it's almost like the knock-on could be even more. Like you could be shooting under the Eiffel Tower, directing from here, but it's your vision happening remotely. So it almost has unlocked this kind of awesome potential of stuff. So like the world is a small place now all of a sudden, very, very small, where it just takes it takes a very good DOP and someone who knows what they're doing on the other side, but it's still the board, it's still your vision that could come into place. And imagine you're walking into pitches where you go, we're shooting in Paris, this shot, because this building is so much better because of all this kind of experience that we've gained working remotely. So, like, again, I might be too optimistic, but I think Portis, me knowing your work, and you work really well with actors. Is there anything, how do you direct performance like this? Not to paint you into a corner.
No, I mean, I'll just be talking out of bullshit if I was to try and give you an answer of like, oh yeah, this is exactly how it's going to be done. But I have no idea. I mean, it's so nuanced. You need to obviously look at the person. You can look at them through a monitor, but so many times when you're giving someone, John, especially again as a copywriter and when it comes to delivery, so sometimes when you're giving someone feedback on a performance, it's a lot more nuanced than just, you know, giving them feedback by giving them two lines, you know, via it's a lot more 3D, if that makes sense. The whole experience isn't just I could be sitting there and I could be giving someone and saying, I didn't think this performance worked well. I think you need to try, you know, maybe just breathe a little bit more, or maybe you just complete static. I mean, if I can't see the frame of the person's feet, for example, it might just be that they're just standing still too much, or maybe they still have they have the wrong shoes on of what, you know, because they thought they were comfortable or whatever. So everyone said, it's not a problem, we're only shooting a close-up, so the pose is comfortable. Meanwhile, that could be the thing that's the reason for why the performance isn't looking right in the close-up. I know I'm like stretching it a little bit here.
Of
disbelief, but I think that is exactly what I'm going to be doing later in the year, and I wish I could give you a better answer, but I think it's, I can't see it working. For some people, yeah, sure. If you're not a performance base, or you know, if performance isn't your strong point, then by all means, maybe it doesn't really, they don't really care anyway. You know, it's like, who cares? It's just like the actor, the meat puppet is, you know, saying their words, and that's fine. But if you really want to have a nuanced performance, I think it's going to be really, 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 really difficult.
That's one of the most amazing things for people to meet.
I'm speaking as the...
we've got to talk to a actor next week.
That's like, luckily, hopefully on the resource course, no actors are freelancers on this thing. Like,
yeah, totally.
Or there's a separate meat actors guild, a meat puppet guild.
Exactly.
Okay, but on that, then
the in terms of performance,
do you find, how many ads is subtle acting performances, are subtle acting performances the make or break scenario for that ad? Isn't it mostly messaging? Isn't advertising to a large degree simply delivering the message while with a thin overlay of like, look, I'm doing a thing that you do, and I'm saying the words of the brand, you know?
To this question, Porteous, hint, he's not serious. This is...
Well, okay. I'm going to give you a very serious answer now.
Okay.
So I wish I had more stories that were uber layered, and, you know, you work on the character and you can, you know, really create this amazing character that you can work, you know, or try and create for the screen. But so this is something that's happened quite a lot in the last seven, 8 years, where obviously as the industry has become a lot more, you know, from a money point of view, things have become a little bit more tight, budgets have become tighter, advertising agencies have become a little bit more, I don't want to use the word conservative, but a little bit more freaked out about, you know, keeping the clients happy. So you tend to get a lot more price and products commercials. So that's problem number one. Okay. So then problem number two, clients have no idea about what a good performance is and what's not a good performance. They know when they look at the final ad and they realize, oh shit, this is actually not great. Then obviously someone needs to be blamed. Hmm. But you'll be sitting in the casting and you'll be giving, you know, you'll be giving feedback. I mean, what's the point of giving a director, letting the director sit in a callback and work with actors, and then you finally sit in a PBM meeting where the clients end up deciding, no, we want number 23, meat puppet 23, meat puppet 55, okay? And you go, well, these guys can't really act. I mean, I work with them. They don't really have a range to actually say what you want to say. But okay, cool. So now you've decided you want to work with these people. I mean, fine. Okay. Sometimes there's a bit of a give and take. So now you're sitting on set trying to work with this person that the client said, that is the person who we're going to be working with. Or if you're working with a celebrity sometimes, you know, they might not actually be able to put string two sentences together. And are you sitting on set, which I think just brings it back to how are you going to be helping someone? Because sometimes you need to feed them the performance. They're literally looking at you. You walk up to them, you act it out. Mm-hmm. They go, okay, I get it. And then they do it for camera and then you film that and then that's what you use. Okay. Yeah,
parroting. But
I don't know how you're going to be doing that if you're doing that remotely. Especially these days. Whereas I think if it's a really beautifully written script, you have amazing actors. Shit. I mean, then I think it's. I mean, there won't be any problems because if you've got a really strong actor, a really strong script, you guys know. I mean, everything starts with the script at the end of the day. If the performance is great, then you're flying. Then I mean, the director essentially will just be looking at the monitor from wherever the hell you might be shooting, just going, awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Let's move on. Next shot.
So there might just be a bit more risk, like a bit more hit or miss, basically, like where if you get a great actor and you've got a good script, then you're pretty safe. But, you know, there's a large margin for error where later you might look at the video and go like, oh, God, that really didn't work out so well. There's a bigger chance of it failing that way.
I think, unfortunately, when you work with really big clients, sometimes I'm not saying this is always the case, but sometimes the scripts are a lot more forced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are going to be the ones that are going to be the tricky ones to do remotely, not necessarily the ones where the scripts are fantastic and it's super engaging. Because I think, yeah, there might be risk, but I mean, if you've written a really funny script and you've got a really funny, you've cast a really funny actor, and then, you know, you do it a couple of different ways. One of them is bound to work.
Sure, sure.
If that makes sense.
Mm.
Yeah, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, no, of course, dude. That's why we're here. I mean, you can't go much further wrong. Sorry, go ahead.
Shut up, John.
Okay, go.
You touch on something, it's again one of those. We're really are a bunch of professionals, no, we're not, on the show. So it's an interesting thing because I like how you started talking from the perspective of an actor, and I just realized we haven't really gone through your bio.
Where no, we haven't.
From what you've done. So
I'm gonna put all that stuff up front.
Yeah, we can. We can just keep it like and show us for the hacks that we are in this sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But Portis, do you mind just?
No, we're keeping it interesting.
Yeah,
it's more of a flashback.
Yeah. Yes. This is okay. Like, good point. Flashback. Young Portis awkwardly at a party.
Young Portis awkwardly. Okay. Again. I'd like you from your point of view, Portis, where you started and how you ended up being a director would be cool because we know each other. I know your background from studying design all the way to directing short films and all this stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've pivoted and zigged and zagged through the years as well. And I'd like to get a little bit of that background.
Okay. Super. I mean, if there's anything that you really want me to just elaborate on, then fine. But it's super simple, way to AAA. That's actually where I met Lucas as well. We studied together, same year group. Finished up AAA. Just started very, very quickly.
If I can quickly interrupt you, being humble, you finished top of your class at AAA. You won every award that there was at that fucking school. Everybody was very jealous of you at that time, including me. Just a little bit of background on that one as well.
Thanks, Lucas.
Okay.
decided that's when I went. Yeah, exactly. that's when I went through my Naomi Klein phase. I read No Logo, and I thought suddenly, oh hell, what have I been doing the last 3 years? Advertising is evil, actually. And so I tried to work in the industry for a very short while, and after literally a few months, I decided, basically, fuck this. I want to work in film because that's where real art is. Never mind the fact that you're shooting commercials, but that was the idea. So I decided, okay, cool. If I want to make movies, what's the best way to go about it? So tried to get into the film industry by using my design background. So did a little bit of art department work on feature films, but then decided if I really want to streamline what's the right word? Yeah, not streamlined, but just take a shortcut to actually making films. I've got to go back to studying. So I enrolled at the shining lights of the Academy, which is after film school. It is just brilliant. I can really highly recommend it for everyone. It is just...
Sounds super sarcastic, gotta say.
Sure,
dude, I am not. Like, they
are. So from this is an audio.
It is amazing.
No one gets your face, by the way.
The awkward answers are going up. There's nothing against people who want to go to answers, I guess, but it's like.
Okay. No, that's why I'm saying it is amazing.
Cool.
I've just been singing their praises. I don't know what you guys are talking about. And so I went to AFTER, weird enough, enrolled in the directing program, and then did some side classes in acting because I realized I don't know what to say to actors. I mean, the first time when you're looking at an actor standing in front of you and you're trying to give them direction, you're like, what the hell am I supposed to say to this person? So I realized if I want to be a good director, I've got to actually know what the hell I'm saying to the person. And then, weirdly enough, that just sort of, strangely enough, became my passion, if I can call it that. I mean, it sucks to say, I mean, sort of young idealistic person, you know, I really did like the acting side, even though I didn't really think I was going to make a career out of it. And then as soon as after finished, at the same time, while I was studying, I started shooting commercials. Getting some money, obviously, that's always a big thing. Started, you know, getting little roles in feature films, especially international feature films, which just makes you feel even, you know, wow, this is something I can actually pursue and I can make a living out of this. Fast forward
I'll interrupt you. Key acting moment for me in Porteous's portfolio is Judge Dredd, the movie that was shot mostly, I think, in Johannesburg. And excuse the sound of the baby if you can hear it, but you play the getaway taxi driver escaping from a judge at the beginning in the opening scene of the movie, looking over your shoulder going like, we got a judge and all that. It was like awesome opening scene. And when you just see Johannesburg being used in it, and it was great. I love that movie.
Portis is being humble with his stuff. It's like, I think you had a role in a soap opera in Seven Alone or something like that. Saw you in many.
So you're bringing up.
Sorry,
I think we need to go on to the next.
He didn't want that out. Okay, he didn't want that to come out. That's right.
I'm putting this at the beginning and the end of the podcast.
Can I ask you something on the from what like in a lot of actors, and I think all this stuff adds up to being a very good commercials director, probably even a features director eventually. If you look at it, Spike Jonze, Michel Gondry, all these guys used to do the same stuff, directed commercials and then broke into to feature films. But from you said acting was your passion, because I saw you I saw you on stage, on commercials, on feature films. Was there anything that stood out to you as more experimental or something that you enjoyed more of those?
You know what? This is going to be such a naff answer, but if I'm talking about highlights when you're working with, in Judge Dredd, right? I really like the DOP. His name's Anthony Dodd Mantle. He did Slumdog Millionaire, for example. I mean, because it's not like I worked with this person and I'm the, you know, the A-list star, and they didn't even know what my name is. You know, I mean, I was, you know, you're literally one of the minor characters, but working in close proximity to people, you see how they work with other people, how friendly they are. They usually tend to be the best people that I've ever worked with, tend to be the people that I've, they are phenomenal in what they do. They are masters of industry, again, air quotes, but they really are masters of their craft. And but they tend to be the coolest people to be around as well. And that was quite a thing for me to realize when you work with these people that are so good. Then you work with other people that are not at the top of their game, that just have the biggest egos ever. And that always just killed me. So I think the biggest thing working in some of these films, you really kind of pick up how you actually need to treat people. You realize how you need to work with actors, obviously. Just see how the heads of department, you know, converse with each other, how they plan. So you kind of like a little bit of it, even though you are on the production itself, you kind of like a little bit of a voyeur, because you kind of, you know, you're just like a sponge. You're just like, you know, just sapping everything up around you. So that's a highlight in itself. I mean, I don't want to get into like various different productions and stuff like that, but that's sort of what you get out of it. So from a learning point of view.
Awesome. Yeah. Sorry. Just that I think for Slumdog Millionaire, didn't he win an Oscar for that?
Yeah. And this is the cool thing. So, right. I'm one of the minor characters on that specific film, and the guy comes up to you. He says, "Oh, hi, my name's Anthony Porteous. Hi, okay, nice to meet you, Porteous. Cool. So, Porteous, we're going to do this, and this. Where I've been on. So, okay, I'm just going to segue to working in commercials as an actor as well. Where you so many times I'd be sitting on set where." I've had once where a DOP was literally shooting over my shoulder, and because he wanted to get a nice frame, he literally grabbed me by my collar of my shirt, the scruff of my shirt, and yanked me around. And I'm not being like a little wussy now by being, oh, you know, you hurt my feelings. He was just pulling me around, couldn't give a shit about this guy. And just suddenly I'm in a shit mood as an actor because this guy was being a dickhead, okay? And then you realize, oh wait, hang on. If I'm in a position like this, I need to make damn sure that the DOP that I work with is really good with people as well. It's not just about being really good at what you do. Obviously, you need to be a great cinematographer, but it's also about the type of person you are. Because again, if you have a really good group of people working on set, it just brings out the best in everyone. If that makes sense.
That makes total sense. That's a really good answer. So you just pick up that experience by going through bad experiences. Absolutely. And that's school fees for you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, or even you know, like standing on set. I mean, I'll give you another shitty example, but then you have, not that I want to, everyone always throws grips and gaffers under the bus, but I mean, imagine you're having a scene now, whether it's for commercial or for feature film, makes no difference, where there's a scripted scene of someone that's supposed to be crying, or there's like an emotional love story, or something where there's, you know, there's got to be sparks between two people, whatever the case may be. This is called a serious scene. Now you have a gaffer and a gripple, you know, his Aussie, and they're standing there and they're just talking shit, you know, they're shooting the shit. They're just, you know, they don't really know what's going on there, but they're just talking shit. They're like, might make some comments, you know, about this actor, you know, your chick's coming just now, you know, you're going to have a kissing scene or whatever the case may be, or stuff like that. We just have this where these people, some people obviously instead just don't have an understanding of what the bigger picture is. And you need to realize even something as simple as the person who's carrying the camera from A to B, and I'm not trying to say that a grip is just literally the person carrying the camera from A to B. It's a lot more complicated than that. But sometimes the simplest role is actually also super important. So you need to, from top down, you need to make sure that you're working with the people that get it, if that makes sense.
This is a very interesting thing because and what I like about your story so far, well, the kind of the foundational kind of training that you've had. So you kind of went from already aesthetic background in design. Then you go into script writing and directing, and then you went into acting. So you can see all these things are like CEOs have to work in every department of their company to try and understand the whole process of production of whatever they're making. So was that a conscious thing, or do you think this just happened?
No, I think it was conscious. I mean, okay. I knew that I had to learn about acting when I was, you know, much younger. I knew that I had to learn a little bit about it, but I didn't think it was going to take over for that long. I didn't think it was going to be like an 8-9 year stint where I actually was working continuously. I thought it was just going to be a quick little sideline thing, and then I could focus on the directing. In hindsight, not that it's that crucial for this podcast of yours, but I wish that I did. Get caught up in the acting side for that. I wish I actually segued back into directing much, much quicker. That's boring.
No, not at all. That's not boring at all. Okay, cool. So you acted for about 8-9 years. What was your kind of big break? How did you kind of swivel?
To directing now.
Term is pivot, right? I mean, come on, Lucas.
Yeah, okay. I would have said
it's your version.
It would have been pivot for the third time in this freaking thing, and it's like jogging. So, like, when did you jog into this news position?
When did you pivot your startup into a paradigm unlocking business?
Paradigm shift your.
When did you move the needle?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
When did the rubber really hit the road for you?
This is actually a very interesting question. So it was just networks. So I started shooting music videos on the side while I was still acting. Like I said, I wish I started a little bit earlier, but that's kind of neither here nor there. And then as I started getting to music videos, I realized, okay, cool, I want to now formally get into shooting commercials again. Shooting my own specs, which some people frown upon, which is totally fine. If if you're in a great position where you're already shooting commercials and stuff, then you're absolutely allowed to look down on specs. But that's how I got my break, if you want to call it that. And was through a network where Lucas, you were the person who put me, I think, into connection with, was it? Oh, sorry. So you through my wife, who was connected with you as well, working together in an advertising industry. My wife was connected with Ruth, who was Ruth Charles. Mm-hmm, yeah. And Ruth Charles became a freelance producer. once she left the, you know, the formal sector of the advertising industry, and through her connection with my wife, I then got called up to basically submit my showreel essentially for a local production company called Golden Plains, because they were looking to expand their roster, and in the end they really wanted to sign me up. And so it was this weird way of through a connection of people, obviously, getting that gig. I don't want to call it, it wasn't such a big deal in the beginning of my career, because I wasn't really sure where this thing was going to take me. And then I think I was signed with Golden Plains for, I think, maybe 3 months, and then I already started shooting commercials. So, and then it just sort of snowballed from there. But again, they were more focused, like I said earlier as well, they were more focused on international work. Not that I'm trying to sign hoity-toity, just that was the sector and what they worked in. So in many ways it was great, because I didn't have to rely on the local industry, but it was also a bad thing, because I didn't really do enough local work as well. So it was, that's I guess my answer, if I'm answering you.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing. So working with you got the strategy was working with more international clients and that stuff. So from, again, now this helps us with the in pitching and stuff. Pitching. So remote pitching, it's not a new thing, but it was there any growing pains with that?
You know, you're talking about pitching from the beginning, the growing pains?
Yes. From working on companies like the big multinationals, all the layers that you have to go through on those things. That just to prompt that discussion.
Well, I think it's there. I mean, the learning curve is continuous, you know. I mean, when you're doing your first few pitches, you don't really know what you're doing. I mean, let's just be honest. When you kind of, you try to put nice references together and you try and do a song and dance and you think you bring something great to the table, and potentially you are, you know, if you're pitching against, maybe you just happen to be also a little bit lucky. You maybe just might not have had the best visual references in your pitch, but your idea was great, and the creatives are, you know, they see that potential, and they obviously go and put you forward to the clients, and you end up getting the job. But then as you obviously grow and you expand your knowledge, you start realizing, oh shit, my pitches, you know, were actually shocking. Then you start over you know, indulging in putting too much things in your pitch. I mean, it's a little bit boring, but you basically start getting way too detailed in whatever you put in your pitch. So then it's you start putting a feature film treatment together for a commercial. It just doesn't make any sense, because especially considering if you're pitching on a job and it's taking you 2 weeks full time to pitch on something and you end up not getting it. I mean, I'm sounding crass now, but I mean, if you're wasting your time if you so there's a really delicate balance of getting your ideas together, but not showing enough to show this is your idea without necessarily over-referencing and getting bogged down too much in the details, if that makes sense.
Speaking of details, can I ask you just to serve for the resource cost, just from a point of, it's mostly kind of advertising professionals, which some of them would have been through a pitch or not. Would you mind just explaining the your pitch process from brief to kind of execution? And you said you have 2 weeks. Well, how do you fill those 2 weeks?
I kind of, in many ways, use it. I rely on the same process that creatives would usually at an agency. You know, you uh, you go into the advertising agency, the creators meet with you, they give you the creative brief. I go away, I spend the next 3 days at least just thinking, not, you know, I don't really get into referencing and stuff like that too early on, just sort of big picture ideas, try and flesh out, just letting your brain do a little bit of the legwork before getting sidetracked with referencing. Once you've in your mind cracked the idea of how you want to, at least how you want to tell the story, you then obviously will start, then you'll start getting into the weeds. You'll start referencing like a mofo, then start putting your documents together, start writing out your exact treatment for whether it be performance, cinematography, edits, music. Again, being careful not to over-reference, but enough. So 3 days brainstorming. I'd say a good 2 days or so of visual referencing, and then at least 2 days of spinning and polishing, and making sure everything looks slick. And I'm quite anal, unfortunately, when it comes to that stuff. So some people, I mean, they just don't really care. And the shit thing is that sometimes, you know, that's not always what's important. You don't always have to have this sparkly, beautiful treatment to actually get the job. But that's my process. I can't help it. That's just the way I am. So that's my streamlined version of the pitch. You can obviously go longer, but I try and avoid doing pitches or putting a treatment document together that takes me longer than, say, what did I say? Like 7 days or so. That's sort of my magic number.
I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed to say, like, from working with agencies, like we put pressure on directors a lot of the time to go, like, can you see us in 3 days? How about 4 days? You know, I'm sure that time is eroded as well in the process. But again, it depends on what the hustle is. Some clients require tighter deadlines. And I suppose this kind of leads me to my next question. What type of projects have you been working on?
Sorry, so I'm just gonna go back to your. Sorry, I just want to set the record straight. So you do sometimes get short deadlines where you don't have the time, and that's obviously when you can outsource to researchers to help you with extra work. But I was just talking about my ideal scenario where you have resources and time at your disposal. Sure. So your next question was, what have I been up to of late? So
yeah, like, okay. Yes. Well, I think I was more trying to get to the type of clients that you've been working on, and like as an example, when you said you worked on overseas work, and then even if there's any other projects you wanted to talk about.
So. So let's just be quiet. Let me just separate what I've been working on right now with versus the stuff that I was, you know, kept myself busy with in the last 10 years or so. So the last 10 years have been primarily working with, and Procter & Gamble related work. So it was lots of high pressure work, you know, because there's so many hardcore corporate layers of approvals and things that you need to get through. So in many ways for me, that was my almost getting me ready, or giving me my big match temperament. You know, we're sitting in a, it's not, I mean, some people I'm sure have done, you know, even potentially who might be listening to this podcast later, that might have done much bigger jobs. But I mean, sometimes you're sitting in a pitch sitting in a PPA meeting, and there's literally people phoning in from China, Rome, Geneva, the USA, so you have, and everyone thinks they're super important, obviously, on the call. So everyone needs to get there, have their two little, or their 30 seconds of having that. So you need to navigate those out. And there's lots of pressure, lots of money, not necessarily for me, of course, but lots of money for the project itself. So in many ways, that was great for me to just learn or just get comfortable around that sort of scope of work. Was it the most creative work? I'm going to say 75% of the time it wasn't necessarily the most creative work, but it really helped me a lot. And I can say I wouldn't do that work going forward. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to do some for the show and some for the dough, right? So it's just, it is what it is. If I could just do beautiful creative work for the rest of my life, obviously I would just be doing that, but I can't. Even some of the big shot directors out there, and I'm definitely not one of them, they also have to do work that they're not necessarily going to think that, wow, this is the best creative work, but there's different levels of what you do. You know what I mean? That's part of the job sometimes. And I do sometimes find, and not to go off on a tangent, but, you know, sometimes I think the success that I've had in the past, and especially with returning clients, was the fact that even though it might not have been the most creative board, when the agency sits with you and they're trying to get you to do a good job, you've got to show the same amount of enthusiasm for their board versus the most creative board that you've ever had in your life. Because everyone knows if they're trying to sell something, that's not necessarily a Grand Prix winner. But everyone's doing their job. And if you're going to be the dickhead coming in there and going like, oh, this is so fucking boring. Now I've got to try and, you know, I've got to polish this turd. I mean, there's nothing worse than working with a person like that. So I think, you know, if you're super professional, you do your job, you try and actually, and you try and whatever the pitch was, or the creative brief was, if you try and actually do something better with it, and you're still giving, trying to, you know, offer creative solutions for the, especially the agency, obviously, then I think that really goes a long way, because then everyone feels, okay, at least this person is actually trying to help me do something better than what we potentially would have had. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here.
You had such a nice way of putting it just now, saying it's big match temperament. And again, you learn on all these things. So once you put things into perspective, if you're on these big calls with the Procter & Gamble, Unilever, all these people, it puts another project, makes it so much easier. You know, like every bit of experience is built on the next one. And I think we actually rise in these occasions. Like, and I think you're completely right. It's to conserve your energy to put your energy into everything and make it as good as you can, whatever's in front of you. And because no job is perfect. And you touched on two things there. It was like you put the same amount of energy as you do into the creative jobs as you do the non-creative jobs. That way, each one builds on the next one. Because like a personal creative hit rate of 10% of the work is really exceptional. And that just kind of informed that. Yeah. But like that's me being toxically optimistic again. So yeah.
Right. What else? So I want to draw the focus back to me here and my needs, which are no. I just wanted to. Okay, so I think we've heard kind of like a little more context now about like what Portis's career has been, and in terms of like freelancers, it's interesting that you have swiveled from designer to actor to director, you know, and done it very effectively.
I'm gonna try and come up with different names for Swivel now. So did you Lazy Susan across to a different direction?
So then I Lazy Susan to direction. That's cool. Then I rotated about 90 degrees and went directly. What advice would you give if someone's a freelance copywriter like me, or a freelance art director, and they want to now, let's say, get into shooting something, whatever it might be, but being the mind behind the content and being like, even if it's completely shoestring and it's all them, what kind of resources or what advice would you give to someone who says, I want to shoot my own ad? Like whether it's a spec, whether it's for my family business or a friend's company, how can I minimize the chances of it making it just like a total nightmare?
Okay, that is
That's a tough question.
That's a tough question.
How do you direct?
Success.
I like what you touched on there, John, from a freelance point of view, because you think smaller clients can't shoot stuff. And I don't buy that. Because at the moment, content especially on social media, you need like how many posts are you going to shoot of your leather bag? You know, there's at some point there has to be some kind of richer content, and I think that informs that at least.
Yeah, well, let me rephrase the question to what are some of the ways to how can you make video content that's like in a really interesting, like a cost effective way? Like, what is something?
Yeah.
How do you think?
Man? No. I totally get it. I think it's actually, it's a nice question, but I'm sure you guys know the answer yourselves as well. Anyway. It all starts just with the idea. It doesn't matter. It irks me to say this because obviously I like creating really beautiful work. I like creating films where there's lots of work in the audio, whether it's minimalistic or highly complicated. I like working on those things because it inspires me, you know, it challenges me. But the thing that at the end of the day comes down to what the idea is and the script. If you have a cool idea with a cool little script for a company, it could literally be you. I know it sounds ridiculous. It's that cliche of you can go and shoot it on your phone, but you can go and shoot it on your phone. If it's cool enough, that's fine. And then obviously just spend a little bit of money on the sound, because if the sound is shit, you can forget about it actually going anywhere. You can forgive horrible visuals, but not if the sound is bad. That's sort of the golden rule. So the opportunity is always there. I wouldn't necessarily follow my own advice, but that is, I think, really only. I mean, why do you get all these, you know, little Instagram, you know, viral little videos or TikTok and, you know, all these short little videos that are just so cool, and it just takes no effort. It's just because the idea is cool. Not saying it's necessary, just because you think your idea is cool, it's going to necessarily be viral, obviously, because I don't think, that's another story altogether. But you can create cool content with basically no money.
No, I think it's relative to what you're doing. So as an example, the delusion of, okay, so I'm going to put my product in the middle of a stadium filled with people and then film it with my phone. It's like... If you just think about the idea and the limitations of what you have and what you have to work with production-wise, the solution can be whittled down into something that's interesting. And I think what I always used to love about when we'd come up with an idea, we'd actually sketch it out. Most of the time, I have storyboards and everything ready because clients needed to visualize things, and it was like, once we got that idea past the client, I got excited because I got like, okay, cool. Someone, we're going to brief a director now to plus our idea. So whatever that we brief them, have an open mind about how they're going to make it happen. Cause usually we don't have any money to do this. Like we're also shitting ourselves because we've got the cars doing X or the person's doing this and we need stuntmen, blah, 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 blah. So we don't really know how we're going to actually sort this out. We kind of have an idea, but once we actually start talking to a production house, this is where it actually starts really, because the money needs to now stretch. And I always used to love it. A lot of the directors, you aim very high, and like you have a selection, and you kind of send out the request for pitches and see if anybody's going to bite. And it's always like kind of like
exactly what you should be doing.
Yes, which is a complete potluck, crossing your fingers and everything. And then I always, the job usually goes to the person who's showing the most enthusiasm and going, we can make this happen. We can do this, but you're going to have to work with us. We're going to have to do this, that. Some directors just came back and said, oh, by the way, I rewrote your whole ad. This is the new ad. And we're like, well, that's not what we sold. We're dead in the water here. So there is a certain amount of enthusiasm, and then there's like kind of arrogance in that in a sense, but at the same time having to have,
which is also good, I guess.
It's good because it makes you think about it. It makes you think about it in a different way. So
if the clients are open-minded enough to go with whatever the person suggested,
it usually
that actually makes it better. But if it doesn't,
yeah, it usually comes out. If they,
okay.
No. What I mean is, the client will be convinced when you go like quality for money. So it's usually the you go to the creative solution, but then the thing is within budget, and then they go like, oh, that's cool. Okay, cool. Right. So I don't have to go to my boss and ask for more money, which was actually the clincher most of the time. But it's like to try and find that Venn diagram of where everybody can kind of go, like we get the best creative project for that budget. Mm. Was there any projects that kicked your ass? Did I say products or projects?
I'm going to go with projects.
Cool. I think I said products. I mixed the two up.
Swiveling Susan. What did you say?
The lazy Susan or turning on your wheel?
Lazy Susan.
doing a head spin? I'm here all
day. Yeah, I mean, you might have to cut this out later. I don't know. We'll have to see how I can tell you the story without. It's not actually that. So, I work with star. I didn't really know who she was, but she was a star, and man, it was so tough because it was a really big client, lots and lots and lots of money. The star was paid a shit ton of money. So there was just lots of pressure on everyone to get this thing off the ground. And I'm not going to get into the weeds of, it's not a funny story. I mean, where, for example, we'd be ready to shoot, in the morning, say at 7 a.m. we were ready to start filming. She would only arrive after they would only leave the hotel at like 8 in the morning. That's after they had their own breakfast, but they should have been on set at 6 obviously to get ready. I mean, this is just what you deal with sometimes with shooting with this type of person. I'm not bad mother, she was a lovely person, but so they arrive, then it's you only start shooting at like 12 in the afternoon. And you don't get all your shots because then there's a problem with the hair and makeup. And there's obviously lots of moving parts. You know, you're shooting with in certain constraints. I can't get into the details because then I'm going to give away what the whole thing was about. But basically, it's I just remember so much pressure from the clients, and they would just be shitting on me because I wasn't getting the job done, as if I should miraculously be, you know, celebrity wrangling on the side. And after 3 days of shooting, I just remember standing on set, and my producer just came walking up to me, and I had one of those 100-yard stares, and I was just fucking hating my life. It was one of those moments where, and we'd just come off a really difficult shoot just prior to that, so this was just sort of the pinnacle of not having any. You almost don't have anything. You've, after 3 days of shooting, you almost have nothing.
Yeah.
And it's only like a 3-day shoot. And I just remember staring into the abyss and just saying to this guy, fuck, I'm out. I'm, you know, for real. I mean, this isn't a cry wolf situation. We just said, I'm out. Actually, I don't think I can do this ever again. Well, lo and behold, a couple years later, I'm still doing it. But the point is, this is one of those where you just realize how, I mean, I'm just giving you such a shitty, painting the worst picture ever of like despair. But it's just one of those moments, because I don't really get too depressed about jobs. I'm actually quite relaxed, you know, quite easygoing on set. You know, shit happens. What the fuck? You know, you just got to roll with the punches. But in this case, it was just a mountain of shit that I was eating. And so that was my ultimate low. You're okay. Welcome to chop that up, because there's actually like a lot of nothingness in my
I think that stays.
You need to see my face to see this, to see the despair. If it's just a podcast,
you're having a flashback then, right now.
Yeah, like I felt bad for you there. It is a. No, I'm working with a star. It's really hard. The next thing is like, what was a good experience? Like, I think you had learning experiences so far, but there must be an upside to this. The best experience that you have.
I think it's, like, there's no real just one experience. I think it's more of a potentially a cop out, but I think in my experience, the best experience on any shoots, and I'm sure I speak for everyone, that's probably, you know, all five people that's listening to this later.
You're rough. I'll have you know, we have many more than five listeners.
Such a place.
Oh, wow. At least nine.
My mom is going to be so hurt by that. Hey?
And my mom. So I think I can speak, you know, it comes down to working with cool clients, you know, because if clients cool, usually the advertising agency is cool, and that means you can do cool shit. So if you're empowered to just, hey man, we believe in you, just fucking do something cool, then as the director, whenever you're speaking to the creatives, obviously they're on your side. They also just give you the thumbs up. It's easy to work with. The relationship is easy. And obviously if you then have the clients as well, that's just eager to play ball and actually be okay with sometimes, you know, if you present it with a better solution on the day of the shoot, for them to go, you know what, fuck it. It's actually what we're seeing right now is much better than what we had planned, so let's just roll with it. That is, I think, the best. It's the worst when you're working with even a script that doesn't really work on paper, and it works less when you're shooting it and the client is immovable. And that makes the advertising agency immovable, and that makes you immovable, and it's just a shit show for everyone.
Right. Yeah, when these kind of things work, I think it's quite similar to directing is similar to being a conductor in an orchestra. And when everything is working together beautifully, it's creating some kind of harmony, then it's like being on stage with a cast that's got it completely down, you know, like it's magical. It's show business. I think that's what it's like, the behind the scenes production version of show business, which I've always been very jealous of when it comes to directing. Until I realized that directing is essentially being like a manager. Like your job is to make people, bring out the best in other people.
Who was you would probably know this, but who was that conductor where they asked him, what's your instrument? And he said, I play the orchestra.
Right.
Do you know?
No idea, but I know what you're talking about, but I don't know.
That's a great answer. It's a great answer to but at the same time, but I can hear an Italian accent in that. I play the orchestra.
Yeah, the orchestra is it's French, but we both just did French, by the way.
Sorry. I was hoping mine would be nondescript because I'm scared there's a hashtag or something that happens with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm just aware of everyone's time. We're getting down towards dinner time here, and I want to ask, how do you think the pandemic is going to change filmmaking in South Africa? Like in the next few months, like, is it going to wipe it out? Is it going to wipe out a lot of, obviously it's already hitting a lot of jobs and all that kind of thing. Are things going to become more granular, smaller budgets, making a plan, stuff that looks a lot more like TikTok than it does look like the old school, you know, Alan Gray, huge narrative production ad. In your mind, what are we kind of seeing in the ads coming up? Are we going to be seeing face masks in every ad from now on because they're admitting reality?
Sure. Do I have to stick to just South Africa?
No.
I the cool thing I think that this it really has obviously change everything. And I think it's in many ways from a creative industry point of view, I'm not talking about people that have lost their jobs. That's obviously awful. But from a changing the landscape point of view, I think it is actually amazing. I think there are going to be a lot of opportunities now for people to be offering more solutions than what we had in the past when it just came to, like you said, the really big brand ads. Then you have maybe like a smaller tier under that. And then you had like the homemade ads that people would put on, say, maybe like a YouTube pre-roll for a local podcast or whatever the case may be. Whereas I think now the cool thing is with all of this, you know, shooting remotely and coming up with more creative solutions of how to actually be shooting, I think the cool thing is that many directors specifically, I'm just talking about the film industry now, are trying to figure out ways of how to actually streamline the process. And that might, some people can pivot, where other people obviously can't. And I think that the great thing is that the people that are that have the capacity to actually, again, roll with the punches and actually be able to
amenable to change.
You know, I think if you know, the cool thing is that people that can change will change. And in many ways, people that can't change, they're going to get stuck in a certain system, in a certain way, which I think, at least from my point of view, because I'd like to think that I'm a person that can adapt quite well. I like the challenge of trying to figure out new solutions to, again, still creating high quality content. And I don't even use content because it's got its own baggage, but high quality commercials and stories, high quality storytelling, but with, you know, produced via different systems or alternative systems, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And my go-to reference is always like, whenever working on big productions, I was always, it's a color grading, right? And there's a whole suite for that. There are agencies who do, they've got massive machines and they change the colors of certain parts of the thing and they block out bits and all that kind of thing. And for me, that was always like the definition of now you're working on a thing with a big budget, because the whole person who's just changing the color that's already been shot in a camera that's supposed to give you the best color. And that position for me is like, I don't know how it exists anymore. Because
speaking as an art director, shut your filthy mouth. there's so much, there's whole color theory, but yes, I know what you're saying. There's big resources being paid to certain things, and there are new technological ways of changing that color. That color still needs to change.
Yeah.
That's still, that cloth still needs to go into
the. It comes out of the red crap. Like, obviously, it's like in like very flat tones and all that kind of thing. It needs to be graded, absolutely. But like when you look at content being shot for the internet and all that kind of thing, people are shooting on their phones, which have got an automatic color grading applied to it and all that kind of thing. Like, is there, for me, that the color grading, it feels like a very specific, very old school.
Well, job. Can I, sorry to interrupt you, but I think the, so I'm with Lucas on the
obviously thanks, copywriter.
John,
as long as the words are there, I don't care about what it
is. Know your place.
but do you put necessarily like an Instagram filter need? Over. Yeah.
Can exactly. You shoot this in HEFA?
You do have, so you, why have a, I mean, this is going to sound, I mean, I guess you can get a ton of hate for this, but why have a really big suite, you know, with big couches, you know, you're paying a shit ton of rent for the suite, because you obviously want, you know, when the clients come, you want the whole song and dance. But at the end of the day, you just need the machine. Yeah. You need the operator. You need the big, I would rather pay for the best colorist just for that person with their machine, instead of having to pay money for the overheads of being brought coffee while I'm sitting in. I mean, I'm sounding disrespectful because, I mean, a lot of people enjoy that. But I would rather just look at better ways of where the money is spent. Again, because that means the money could have gone somewhere else.
Sure. So, John, just to come into defense again of the colorist, is that you need the service, not necessarily the treatment, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
YouTube. So if you get onto YouTube now and you go to see people who vlog and do put their own podcasts, there's entire tutorials of how to get your lighting right, there's entire tutorials of how to get your color right, because you still have to do those things. Sure. It's not like these TikTok videos. These TikTok things are very, very considered. Especially the ones that go unless it's a fight or something like that, but people, they dress well, like the stupid TikTok dancers are like, the lighting is right, the bikini is the right shade for her, for the skin tones. It's all those things are considered for complete obvious reason. But art, why do we need this art thing? You can just shoot it with your phone. There's going to be an argument for it.
To clarify there, it was more the machine. It's got these two big rolling balls and it's like a whole physical machine. It's in the same way in which you go to a recording studio. And it's a Da Vinci. Yeah. So if you go to a recording studio and they've got like a million channel mixer, and you're there to shoot, to do the sound for your commercial, and you've got like a VO and you've got like a couple of tracks underneath that and maybe some music. And the dude's got like a 72 track channel mixer. And you're like, why do I need all this stuff when all of this stuff lives digitally inside like the laptop all by itself? Like, I don't need any of this stuff anymore, you know? So I think the colorist job is definitely not going to go away.
It's, I know, just, what you're saying.
As Portis is saying, all those accoutrements that come with it, like the free coffee and the massive suite and all that kind of thing, because they're always inevitably, the colorist suite had this like massive TV because it needs to be like representative of the right color. It's a dark room, and for some reason they were always like double volume, and I don't know, it was mad. So,
well, don't you think it's weird that you color grade in a dark suite, but you're going to be sitting on your 99% of the time you're going to be sitting in a room that's normally lit, so you almost need a. I mean, I get it because you want to be consistent, but it's just funny.
Yeah,
totally. No, to be honest, I used to get a little bit annoyed by that. You have to get your baseline right, and then after that, it didn't really. Everything needs to be crafted, but it's not going to be consumed in that way. So, and I remember sitting and doing audio, trying to check audio on my phone. As well as TV, because I know how people are going to listen to this. And then and you could see even the audio guys were starting to mix for phones so that they go one little speaker that's there, and your earphones, that are just different mixes, so that you start kind of trying to find the best way how the people are going to look at it. And you're completely right. It should be in your living room. You must chuck some baby noises into the audio as well to see in the background. So is it sounding good with the sound of the pots boiling in the kitchen and dogs barking and kids like that. So there's reality and then there's idyllic things. And I think part of this process is a bit of a hangover from the 80s that we thought we were making movies. So the clients and everybody wanted that movie making experience, director's chairs, big Dolby sound studios that we went to. And yes, that process has changed, but it doesn't take away from the importance of it. But you don't need that experience. You just need that service. But anyway, that's just me. Wow, I just went on a fucking monologue there.
No, it's all good. I mean, if you think about it, it's totally, I mean, if you think about I think it was even in the 80s, even in the early 90s, the DOP set up the camera. The director only looked through the viewfinder, looked at the image and then stepped away, and the DOP was left to do what he was employed to do. And I think that's the beauty about, in many ways, at least that system, where I think hopefully we can get rid of the bullshit
of all the bells and whistles and actually just focus back on again, output of products instead of bells and whistles. Because I think the stupid tent with, I mean, this is such sacrilege, but I mean, the tent with the cappuccino machines, and it's like, what are we doing here? Is this like an event? Am I in hospitality, or am I actually trying to make a movie or a commercial here? Like, because I don't understand. Like, you know, it's two different. I get it. Like, sometimes if you're a filmmaker, you actually do play Mr. Hospitality as well. But in my opinion, again, I think I'd rather prefer to spend the money in places that I can actually see that money on screen instead of on niceties. But that's just my personal opinion.
The first day I got a cappuccino on set, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. I think I ordered like 10 that day. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. As you say, it's a hangover. I think that a lot of, I mean, maybe also we come from a certain, Gen X / millennial generation when we were kids making adverts, we still remember the Peter Stuyvesant commercials and all that kind of thing where you travel to Hawaii and you travel to Austria to shoot people skiing down mountains and shit. And it was this whole movie making like experience. It was like the light version of that. But our clients were quicker to pick it up than we were. I mean, I remember Lucas and I had a client who would go through the line items on the budget and say, like, what is all this craft services? What is all this food for people? Can't they just bring a packed sandwich to the set and eat that? And at the time, you know, our response was, okay, well, when it comes to the crew, I mean, there's a union here and there are certain rules and they have to be properly catered for and all that kind of thing. But their thinking was right, and I was resistant to it because I was like, no man, we're making a big budget TV ad. This is how it works. You're supposed to be kind of glam and you're supposed to have a cappuccino maker and a tent, and it's an experience, you know. But as you say, that experience has got no benefit to the product at the end. Like, your cappuccino doesn't make the movie better. So I think that
you can kind have your cappuccino.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Just the cappuccino. Just,
it's, just, and actually just, it's just around the block. It's just around the block. Just around the block. There's a little coffee shop.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's Cape Town at the end of the day. There's enough coffee shops.
Yeah, you just make sure that every location is either next to or in a coffee shop. That's why I only write scripts in coffee shops.
Mm. There you go.
Yeah, cool, man. So when it comes to the future of, you know, well, over the next few months and all that, the future of filmmaking, I'm assuming that lockdown is going to kind of continue for a while. Do you think that you're going to see with the people who are struggling, who do have jobs that are tied to being on set, like a gaffer, for example, are they swiveling? Are they lazy Susaning to different positions, or are they kind of just kind of weathering the storm and waiting for the productions to come back?
You know, I think I'm going to give you, I might waffle here, so just wave your hands if I start like losing you. So, I mean, a couple of years ago when we had the water crisis, you know, a lot of productions got cancelled, and already then so many people working in the technical side of the crew already started bailing out anyway. And so unfortunately it's just a trend, you know, when you those little because it was that, then there's obviously electricity, but now you obviously have generators, depending on obviously where you shoot. You hopefully want to rely on house lights, but whatever the case may be. So depressingly enough, with some of the xenophobic, you know, what's the right word? Outbreaks? Can I call it xenophobic outbreaks?
Tension, conflict.
Yeah. Yeah, with those, you know, when you have those, you know, when it was, say, maybe 3 weeks of this going on in South Africa, then you have clients that want to come to South Africa and come and shoot here, and suddenly they go, no, sorry, we're not going to shoot here. So unfortunately those jobs get pulled, and slowly in time, people that were reliant and had stable incomes from working in the film industry in South Africa suddenly those people already started, you know, pulling out. So now I think in many ways that possibly just exacerbates, well, COVID just exacerbates that what was already happening in South Africa anyway. So I think some people will change, and if they find that they have, you know, they're getting the same amounts of money in another industry, because also crews sometimes are like weird, you know, they're like almost like cowboys, you know, they like people that you would expect working on oil rigs. So they can literally lazy suits much easier than other people because they're used to doing it in their careers. You know, like with the tour guide or this or that, and that was great. I think it's pretty much decimated lots of people's livelihoods, and I think we're not going to see many of those jobs returning anyway. I think that's right. My long short answer.
And the exchange rate. I mean, that usually when the South African exchange rate drops, there's a kind of a boost in film production because it suddenly becomes affordable to shoot here again.
I mean, sure, definitely. That always happens. I mean, I think all the inquiries started coming to South Africa again because there was a little spike in the middle. I mean, I'd say probably about a month and a half ago or so, where just suddenly all of these requests started coming in, where obviously our exchange rate was shocking. I think it was 21 odd, if I'm not mistaken, to the euro. So suddenly you have this spike, but now it's gone down again. So it's sure. the whole currency thing. The shit thing is every single job that I've done in the last 4 years, every single time you speak to a client that comes from wherever the hell, you know, whether they're from the UK or from, I don't know, the Middle East, they arrive in South Africa and they say, wow, I can't believe how expensive it is to have a coffee now. Wow, I can't believe how expensive it is to have a burger now. They can, because we're living here, we don't see that stuff.
Hmm.
You know, we just don't see it because we're living in it. Whereas, sure. You know, with they start seeing, they see it a lot more clearly than we do. So I think, unfortunately, as imports become more expensive, because our gear, all our gear is still imported primarily from the US and from Europe, and we pay in dollars and in euros for these things. So it's not like it's unfortunately South Africa itself needs to be cheaper in itself to make it more attractive to foreigners who want to come and shoot. And granted, there's still lots of money, thank goodness, floating around the world, the people who want to come and shoot here. And if you want that location, like you said earlier, if you want the Chapman's Peak, and then you quickly want to drive to Atlantis and you want to shoot in dunes, and you quickly want to drive and shoot, I don't know, you know, a landscape that looks complete, then it makes sense. If you want to do that, those type of productions, then it makes sense. I'm just not sure it makes sense if you want to do a really small production for them to haul ass, you know, halfway across the world to come and shoot in South Africa. I'm not being negative. I'm just saying that in many ways, it's all job related.
Absolutely. Sure.
No doubt, a more favorable economic landscape in South Africa would definitely help. Would help attract more work. That's a long and short.
Yeah. No, I mean, when it comes to inflation, and as you say, like we're kind of the frog in the pot syndrome, where I find myself now, especially during pandemic, like when I go and get fresh stuff, you know, I go into Woolies and I walk around with a cart, and I'm kind of constantly, I'm looking at other people, and all of us are at the same time thinking, I can't afford to shop here anymore. Like I've literally been pushed out of this bracket, and I just haven't accepted that fact yet.
Yeah, absolutely. The classic basket buy, not the trolley buy.
Yeah. And it's like, oh wow, this cappuccino is 27 Rand. Like if you told me that 5 years ago, I would have been like, what the f, are you crazy?
Yeah, absolutely. And how quickly did that go, eh? From like a 18 Rand cup of coffee to the 27, 30 Rand. It's almost double.
Yeah. I think we can all kind of agree that my entire economic system is based on the price of cappuccinos now. And that's my focus. Cool, man. Lucas, anything else from you before we sign off?
No, that's me. What is, thanks. There was a little bit of thing that we just missed a little bit on the hustle in this time. How do you hustle? That I wanted to cover off. And in your Let's head, and if you don't mind, it's just that because we ended up on expensive cappuccinos, which would be a shame for me. It's just that what I find is like a personal thing. When you're in the shit, you work yourself out of the shit. Because there's nothing else. I'd like, if you sit down, nothing's going to happen. So inaction is way, way worse than being on fire. So is there any hustles that you're up to?
Whether it's going to pay off financially, in the short term, I can't necessarily, say yes, cause I don't have a crystal ball, but you kind of have to, you know. And I think the cool thing also about this, this COVID situation is that obviously, you know, going through the weekly existential, what is the meaning of my life? Those questions, it really starts narrowing down what you want to do with your life going forward. And that for me in many ways, has sort of steered where I want to be going. And I've got some stuff planned in the pipeline, which you should know about because it involves you. I'm super excited about the hustle, but that's sort of the very shit cuck answer, but it is a hustle.
I know that you can't go into the product, but all the projects that you wanted to talk about, and yes, we are working together on something, but it's what I hope that at least that this kind of episode does is that we're all kind of feeling in the same boat, you know, like this. And I love what you said just now, that you're also in a bit of an existential crisis every week. There's something, what am I doing with my life? What's going to happen? And I suppose that for anybody listening, it's like, we're all kind of in this at the moment. And the cappuccinos are expensive. We're all noticing it. So it's like, I'm not saying it makes it better, but at least there's a certain sense of comfort. It's not just me, you know, like sitting here getting anxious about how expensive things are getting, are we going to be shooting again? But at the same time, the brain needs to be firing, because this is about the creative economy, I suppose. And then in the creative economy, you either adapt or you kind of do something else, you know. So that is adapting, I suppose. I didn't want to say, well, I didn't want to say die. Because, dude, it's so simple. Because
people do something else, but not die.
Adapt or lazy Susan. And by the way, I'm so happy that that's catching on.
We're going to do that all the time podcast. From now on.
Yeah. It's like, if anybody listening to this, remember, don't try and come up with new jargon. So yeah. Lazy Susan, there we go.
I'm twirling. You know, but I like it. I want to keep lazy Susan. I think it's awesome. I think it's the most anti-jargon phrase in the world.
Sorry about my dog.
Oh, it's all good. Cool, man. Thank you so much for your time, Porteous. It was awesome to get like an insight into kind of like what's going on in your life and the journey of production in general. I think sadly we're still in the phase, like, we're literally still hitting into the main part of this whole pandemic vibe. And no one's, I think, at a point yet where they can go, oh no, cool, I've got this figured out. Here's the solution. This is the way it's going to fix. This is the way it's going to go. This is the future. And this is how it's going to work. Like, I think everyone's still trying to find those solutions. And there's definitely some solutions are being found, but we're not there. We're not out of it yet. We're hardly even into it.
Yeah. All I can really say is that I think ever since I started working in, ever since I left tertiary education, I was basically working from paycheck to paycheck. So it's not exactly like this is anything new for me. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like it's more of the same. Mm. So I think especially people that I think are potentially in a much more tricky situation than me, where they suddenly they might have been fully employed for the last X amounts of years that they've been working. All I can say is it's actually not that bad. You go through ups and downs and months, and you end up actually getting out of it. So it's all good, man.
Yeah, I think it's good advice for any freelancers that you've done this before. You've been looking for work every month of your career for years now. And
exactly.
Just keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Hustlers are going to hustle. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Totally.
Cool, guys. Thank you very much. So much for your time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Thanks very much. That's it for us. Thanks, Bordius.
Cheers, man.
Cheers, dudes. Have a good one.